The Public Safety Committee will come to order. Thank you, members of the public, for showing up. We have, one or two overflow rooms. I hope you can hear the testimony today. In terms of introduction, we're hearing two bills today, House File 241 and 242, by Representative Houseman. We're going to allow 30 minutes for proponents of the bill and 30 minutes for opponents of the bill. These are people who have signed up to speak specifically on this bill. I know that a lot of you would like to testify on the bill, and we will. I know this is going to be an inconvenience for some people, but we will have committee time available Thursday after session, which is, should be around 6 o'clock, for people who want to testify on the bill. We simply don't have time because we have to be out of this room by noon, and we want to give the proponents and opponents an opportunity to speak on this bill. Just wanted to say, for those of you who haven't attended the hearings yesterday, we've had very respectful hearings. We know this is an emotional issue. It's a complex issue, and I would just ask that members be polite in your questioning of members of the public, even if you disagree with what they're saying, or proponents of the bill or opponents of the bill. This is an opportunity for us to have a discussion, a dialogue on this issue, and hopefully find some solutions and come up with a bill later on this month. So that's sort of my ground rules. Representative Cornish, who's the lead on this committee, has been helpful in trying to maintain that that atmosphere in this committee. He and I have strong opinions on the issue, but relative to the committee process, we're of the same mind that we need to have a respectful discussion. So with that, I also want to say that some members have to leave, and usually we go until 11:30. We have this room until noon, so if you have to leave, you'll just have to leave. So with that, all of these bills will not be voted on today. They will be laid over for possible inclusion in a larger omnibus gun violence prevention bill. There's no amendments to these bills, and we're here to learn more about the content. So with that, Representative Houseman, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 241 for you, and it will be the intention of the chair to lay that bill over. Welcome to the committee, Representative Houseman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know yesterday you talked a little bit about statistics, but I think it helps to frame the issue again by talking about those. We have statistics for both gun deaths and gun homicides, and I believe yesterday you used the number 30,000 people are killed by firearms each year. More than 30 are shot and murdered each day. One-third of them are under the age of 20. Just to put us in the context of the world, and these are gun homicides, the averages annually. Less than 50 in Japan, less than 150 in Germany, Italy, France, other European countries, less than 200 in Canada, and more than 10,000 in the United States. And just given the events of the last few years, it's a time then for us as policymakers to look at that and ask questions and think about ideas and try to see if there's a way through. Issues that should be dealt with? What separates us? Why are we an outlier in the world? Are we more evil? Are we more hateful? Are we more angry? Do we have a higher level of mental illness? I think none of those things are true. I think we are like everyone in the world, for the most part, pursuing life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and a healthy life. But there is one component that sets us apart, and it's a sentence. The Second Amendment. I've heard from a lot of people in the last few days about that. And I wanted to just speak that sentence for a minute. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. That first part of the sentence is one we don't hear very often. The one frequently repeated are those last few words, shall not be infringed. But the first part of it, and this is what will weigh heavily on you, what does that mean, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state? It is at least in part, I think, one of the frames that will have to happen for you. And there are a number of people, you've probably heard from many, and I have, who have suggested we don't have a right to have this conversation today, that the basis of the bills and the discussion are unconstitutional. And I thought it would be important to at least reference the decisions and some quotes, one from Justice Antonin Scalia. Like most rights, the Second Amendment right is not unlimited. It is not a right to keep and carry any weapon whatsoever in any manner whatsoever, and for whatever purpose. And then Justice Alito, later, the first one was the Heller decision, and then Justice Alito in the McDonald decision, we made it clear in Heller that our holding did not cast doubt on such longstanding regulatory measures as prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, laws forbidding the carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools and government buildings, or laws imposing conditions and qualifications on the commercial sale of arms. We repeat those assurances here. So two people reflected on that. And I think those are the kinds of questions, as your committee looks at all of the bills, you look at the entire sentence, you look at some of the advice that you've been given. Now, the Supreme Court didn't help you out. They didn't tell you how to do this. And so the work of this committee is going to be very difficult. But I think because we've all heard from so many people, I think just reflecting on some of the themes would be helpful. One of them referred to the Second Amendment. He said, I just wanted you to see that Second Amendment again and understand what it means, especially the part after the comma. But there's the problem. We can't just look at the part after the comma. We have to look at the part before the comma, that well-regulated militia. And so I think as people talk to us about this, we hear other themes, and here is one. When it comes to the Second Amendment, the drafters of our Bill of Rights understood that in order to guard against a tyrannical government, that all men, especially those between 19 and 45, should have weapons at least as effective as any future potentially tyrannical government might possess, in order to bring that government under control. That's moving in another direction in this discussion, seeing that much in that sentence, that it specifically, they even name ages of people. We've become sort of caught in a culture about that sentence, and we see many different things in it. Some have said that that it's an unconstitutional bill and that I am guilty of treason because I bring it forward. Others suggest that, in fact, an author of this bill would be the terrorist. And the emotions are strong around that. The bloodshed that will result in this war against our Constitution will be on your hands. If anyone comes to take our guns away for an unconstitutional law, there will be a war. There will be bloodshed, and bloodshed will be on your hands. This is not a threat from me, but my opinion on what will happen if an unconstitutional bill is passed into law. I'm sharing the views of people who have reflected on these bills as a way of setting a context for the discussion that you will have. After the 9/11 event, our country changed, and all of us gave up a little freedom. None of us had the freedom to just walk through an airport as we might have. We all sort of had to prove that we were safe before we could move through. It was a very different time. And except for maybe a little grumbling, I think we all realized why we were giving up a little bit of freedom, because something had happened. And this was how we were responding in order to have that safety. There was not a revolt, maybe grumbling, but no revolt. I took my granddaughters to the movie over Christmas vacation. And on the way to the car after the movie, my granddaughter said, all the time through the movie, whenever somebody was moving through the theater, I thought they were a shooter. And she said, but I didn't tell you, because I thought if I told you what I was thinking, then you'd start thinking about it too. This was a granddaughter reflecting on an experience. And that is part of, I think, what brings us here and opens our minds to look at a number of options. Because those children live in a very different world than we did. They process what should be a lighthearted evening in a very different way. So how can the world feel safer for her? Some think more guns will bring us to that safety, and others fear that kind of world. Mr. Chair, as sometimes happens, long before this hearing was scheduled, I agreed to speak to, I'm the opening speaker at the Ordway for a group of school children at 10:30. And so I'm going to leave for a little while. Heather Martin is going to suggest the kind of parameters of the bill, and I think has some further opening statements setting the context. And as soon as I fulfill my obligations down there.
Representative Hausman, will you be back for 2:41?
I believe
2:42?
I believe this will be a relatively brief visit.
Okay. Is Representative Slocum, is she here? I was trying to get someone to, we can probably go ahead with the bill if you're not here, but let's proceed. Thank you, Representative
Hausman. And I'm assuming that that she will go through the bill. We do, by the way, you said no amendments. We do, Representative Mullery and others have suggested some changes, and I think a few people will speak to some of those suggested changes, but I heard you say you didn't really want to reshape the bill.
Anything that's substantive we're not going to take.
Yeah. So I think some people will speak to.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Hausman. The first testifier today, remember, we have, I'm going to try to keep this for a half hour to the proponents and a half hour for the opponents, and we've just keep cognizant of the time so we can hear the other bill also.
When will we be taking questions for the testifiers at any point, especially with respect to the specifics of the bill?
If we can keep them sort of brief, Representative Lash, because it's just if we want to hear both bills by noon.
Can I do my question now then, or do you wait till it's presented?
Why don't we present it first? I think your question is
right here. Ms. Martin, please go through the chair.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Martens.
We will, I think we should present first because your questions might be answered in the explanation.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Yeah, I'll wait until it's presented, Mr. Chair. It's a brief question.
Ms. Okay. Martens, right. Please.
Good morning. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Heather Martens, and I am Executive Director of Protect Minnesota, working to end gun violence. And what I would like to do is to, while I'm presenting this, to bring up Brent Gertek and John Egelhoff, who are experts who can help answer questions as they may come up.
Very well. The testifiers will come up, please.
This bill is a renewal of the assault weapons ban in a different form. There was an assault weapons ban on the books, federal law, that expired in 2004. There were problems with that assault weapons ban in that the definition was partly a list of particular models of assault weapons that were being used in crimes at the time. And the definition was too easy for manufacturers to circumvent. This bill addresses those issues by using features that are related to functionality and that help to distinguish assault weapons from your regularly used hunting rifle. And what I'm going to do is, I think since a lot will focus on what the definition is of the weapon, I'm going to defer those questions to Mr. Gertek and Mr. Egelhoff. But basically what this does is it establishes a crime for manufacturing, transferring, or possessing certain assault weapons. It provides for the disposal or registration of existing assault weapons. And it provides criminal penalties, and basically there's a grandfathering clause is what that means. That if the assault weapon is already in someone's possession, it is not taken away. It is instead registered in much the same way that machine guns are currently registered under U.S. federal law. Machine guns are considered Class 3 weapons, and there is a process kind of similar to this by which those weapons are registered, and there are certain requirements around owning those. I would like to point out that that law establishing machine guns as that particular special kind of weapon is possibly one of the most effective gun violence prevention laws on the books. There are no crimes being committed with assault weapons, I mean with machine guns in this country as a result of that. So, I'll open it up to Brent.
You can just pull the microphone up to you, sir, and introduce yourself for the record.
And this is the picture that I think the committee has.
We have the copy of the picture, yeah.
All right, so.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Can you just introduce yourself for the record, please?
Sure. Brent Gertek. I'm from French River, Minnesota. And I make guns for a living, but it's muzzle-loading guns for a living. But that's what I do, and I'm a mechanical engineer. And what I'm going to do is speak about, like it says on the picture here, the anatomy of an assault weapon. They have certain features or architectural features, sometimes we call them, that enhance their lethality. Some of these are more important than others, and some of them probably, frankly, don't do a lot. But there's a few features of an assault-type weapon that make it more useful for combat situations, which would include, unfortunately, mass shootings. And I think the main one, first of all, is the detachable magazine, a large detachable magazine. That's, I guess, a given. But there's other features. They're made so that they could be fired rapidly with a modicum of combat accuracy at short range. You're talking about cartridges, rifle cartridges, but still rifle cartridges that are more mild than the 308, 30-06, 270 kind of stuff that are so popular with hunters that use center fire weapons. Less recoil. It's easy to recover for a backup shot or a number of backup shots. Also, assault weapons, they're designed, and they've been this way since the 1940s. If you look at the picture, you'll see that the center line of the barrel, in this case with an AR-15 or AR-15 derivative, actually intersects the footprint of the butt plate. So what that means is, as you fire the weapon, the muzzle is going to flip up less. It's not going to climb as much. It's going to buck you more, but it's not going to climb up as much, and that really helps in making the weapon more suitable for rapid fire. I don't know about the barrel shroud so much. I don't think that's much of an issue. The flash hider could be something of an issue. It's not mentioned on there, but it's on there, and that could be an issue if you're firing into a a crowd of people in dim light, it's you're less likely to be your vision's less likely to be impaired by the flash of the weapon. Yeah, that's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Gertek. Next.
Good morning. My name is John Egelhoff. I'm from Bemidji, Minnesota. I'm a retired FBI agent, private detective, and in addition to some comments I'd like to make, I can, if you would allow me to further elaborate on this description. Assault weapons will often have telescoping stocks, which aids in their concealment. They generally tend to be shorter barreled than a hunting rifle. They are made for close-in combat. The detachable magazine has a quick release that allows the quick exchange of of any sort of magazine, including either a stick or drum magazine, and can accept magazines holding up to 100 rounds. The barrel shroud is an important detail because it protects the hand of the shooter when a person is firing many shots in quick succession, such as in a combat situation or in a mass killing. Otherwise, the barrel heats up incredibly fast and gets incredibly hot, and a person would not be able to hold it. The calibers of the weapons are not full-length military calibers, such as the 30 caliber, 30.06, 308. They're specifically smaller calibers, shorter length, smaller bullets, projectiles. That allows the individual soldier for whom these are designed to carry more ammunition. They are less recoil than a standard rifle round, such as a 30 caliber or 30.06, because it allows less recoil, which is a factor in close-in combat shooting. The other factor is the light bullet. For example, in the 223 or 5.56 millimeter military round is traveling at substantially faster speeds than either a 308 or a 30 caliber bullet. Its light, its small size and lightweight creates a substantially more serious wound when it impacts on a human body.
Thank you, Mr. Egelhoff, for your testimony. Ms. Martens.
This was presenting the bills. This part of the
presentation.
Time.
Okay.
This part of the presentation, not testimony, right?
This is all part
it's
of
all
the.
All part of testimony.
It's all part of it.
All right. Then I'll make the rest of the opening on this. I would like the committee to consider the reason that we're talking about this today, which is the children who have been lost in the Sandy Hook shooting and in many other shooting deaths. I think you need to remember, as you consider this, who those children are and how their families' lives have been impacted by what happened in Sandy Hook and what happens to others all over the country in mass shootings in this country. I have a brief statement from Betty Beyer, who is a grandmother of a Sandy Hook child. She lives in Edina. Her granddaughter survived the shooting. She says, "My youngest granddaughter, Elise Beyer, escaped her school on December 14th and was with the kids who ran to the fire station. She heard the Bushmaster rifle shots, however, as she left. What a horrible experience for a child to bear. As her family learned of the tragedy, there was a 45-minute period in which her parents didn't know if she was alive or dead. My friends seem stunned when I tell them this. Most of them say, well, this certainly brings it close to home, meaning Minnesota. All four of my grandchildren went to Sandy Hook Elementary. Their town is one of the most boring places on earth. Their home is on a site of a former orchard, and there are still small farms down the road. My son, Elise's dad, tells me that after the shooting, many reporters were stationed on his street because Adam Lanza lived on the same street near them. Some reporters from the BBC interviewed my son, asking him what he thought of the weak gun laws in the U.S. Joe said, "I bet you think we are all nuts here in the U.S." And they answered, "Yes, I'm afraid we do." As legislators, we don't need any more statistics on how many gun tragedies we have in the U.S. every day. I'm simply asking the question, why do we need to have guns that can kill as many people in as short a time as possible in the hands of anyone but the military? The world is watching us. In the name of God, let's do something about gun violence. Betty Beyer. From Protect Minnesota's perspective, we've been dealing with gun death for so many years and working to prevent it. I need to tell you that assault weapons have killed people in our community. I mentioned specifically Mona Davis, who lost her son in North Minneapolis, killed by an assault weapon. She could not work for a year after that. She lost her home to foreclosure. Her life is devastated, and I think we need to keep that in mind. The world is changing. Hunting has changed. There are fewer hunters out in the woods these days. It's not as popular a sport. So what has happened is that sport has become, by the gun industry, more militarized, and there is an attempt to change the nature of that. The nature of firearms has changed considerably since I was a child. I learned how to shoot when I was 10 years old. I grew up in a farming area, and I have never come across somebody who I was growing up with who used an assault weapon for hunting. The question is, if we don't do something now, where does that changing world stop? If there has to be an armed guard everywhere, does that armed guard also have to have an assault weapon? And I leave you with that. Now I'd like to move to Mr. Egelhoff.
Mr. Egelhoff.
Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm a firearms owner, a firearms instructor, a hunter, a concealed carry permit holder, an NRA member, and a Second Amendment supporter. I retired from the FBI after 28 years, during which time I was a SWAT team member, a firearms and tactical instructor, and sniper for the FBI. I have carried and used all sorts of firearms in my career, including assault weapons, submachine guns, and other weapons. I have become intimately familiar with the human carnage left by the criminal misuse of firearms, including being the on-scene commander and case agent in the 2005 mass murder at Red Lake High School. I ask for your support today in stemming the inundation of our country and state with assault weapons and high-capacity magazines by passing HF 241 and 242. Assault weapons are compact, self-loading, detachable FET magazines, and their high-capacity magazines have caused mayhem in the U.S., including Minnesota, for decades. In addition to the murders and woundings of law enforcement officers over the years, they have been implicated in the 1987 Stockton, California, Cleveland School playground shooting with left 5 children dead, 28 wounded. The 1987 North Hollywood, California bank robbery, 18 citizens and police officers wounded, and many others, including the Red Lake High School shooting. And it's a not well-known fact that in that shooting, the shooter attempted to use a DPMS AR-15 with 30-round magazines, but jammed it while he was loading it and left it back in a house. Countless first responders, teachers, survivors, family, and friends have been left mentally traumatized and scarred by these crimes. Firemen wonder if they will be attacked with a rifle made for combat. Teachers nationwide cope with armed intruder drills. Surviving teachers and first responders have never returned to work in many cases. Whole communities and our country have grieved. Only the gun industry has benefited. Simply put, to me who is, excuse me, with the flow of battlefield weapons and high-capacity magazines to the public continues. Available for sale, among other assault weapons, are so-called pistols, which in reality are chopped-down AK-47s, supplied with one 30-round magazine. All sorts of weapons are available, including drum magazines holding up to 100 rounds, including ones for Glock pistols. When most of us were children, none of these weapons or magazines were available. Shotguns, deer rifles, and the rare handgun were the rule, not current-issue military weapons made it for close-in, desperate combat where fire superiority and acceptable collateral damage can take precedent over marksmanship, with or without a background check that can only search for a conviction or adjudication. Anyone can acquire a weapon that in seconds can decimate a room full of innocent children and dedicated teachers or turn a cinema into a slaughterhouse. To me, who has held the bodies of dead children and teachers and see my fellow friends and law enforcement officers slain, it is simply a moral issue. These weapons and components have not one legitimate use outside the battlefield or in the hands of a policeman. Many veterans of our current wars, including General Stanley McChrystal and others, who are themselves NRA members like myself, have spoken out against these weapons and magazines being in civilian hands, as have many of our law enforcement leaders. Even the use of high-capacity magazines is a fraud. There is not one grand jury in this country who would not look askance at the firing of over a few shots in what otherwise had been a legitimate use of deadly force by a citizen. Simply put, the only real use for these tools is, in fact, to kill our fellow citizens, and they are the preferred tools of the mass killer. The bloody reality is the absence of these weapons and components would lower the lethality of these killers. To those who would say that the 2004 assault weapon ban was not effective, I would reply, if it was still in place, these people would not have been able to easily acquire either assault weapons or high-capacity magazines. James Holmes, Gerald Lochner, Nancy Lanza, Sung-Hoo Choi of Blacksburg, Virginia, Major Nadal Hassan, Fort Hood, Texas, Wade Michael Page, William Spengler of Webster, New York, and Anders Breivik of Oslo, Norway. In the Oslo shooting, in which 69 children were killed and at least 33 injured by gunfire, a U.S.-made Mini-14 rifle was used with 10 30-round capacity magazines acquired from a U.S. supplier. I thank you for your consideration.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Mr. Egelhoff. Ms. Martens, we have several more witnesses, so however time that you go over, we set a half hour for proponents. So if we go over, then the opponents will have the same amount of time. I want to just make that clear. And then I don't know what that will do to hearing the second bill, but, you know, I want to give your testifiers an opportunity. So.
Okay. Do we have, how much time do we have? Are we at 30 now?
Not quite, but we're getting close.
Okay.
So, but if you want to take a few more minutes, we'll give the opponents the same amount of time because they have things to say, too.
Yes.
Unless anyone had any questions for Mr. Egelhoff or Mr. Gertek, if we could make them breathe.
Does that come out of our time as well?
No. We'll give you the time. But I think this is important. If Representative Cornish, quickly,
well, first
if you could.
I'd like to get an okay from you to pass that out there.
Ask your question, Representative Cornish.
It was really painful listening to your testimony in the previous one about ballistics because it defies everything that I know. I just made some notes here and I'll start out. First of all, could I go back through the testimony? It won't take me long. Okay. No, it won't take long.
Okay.
The objectionable letters that Representative Hausman. First of all, I find it very objectionable that you come down to present a bill and then take off and don't take questions.
Representative Cornish, she had another commitment. That's okay.
I know, but it's an Ordway commitment over a gun hearing. So, the objectionable letters, the letters I received in the Gay Marriage Amendment would make those pale in comparison. We're used to receiving objectionable letters from a few people. The theater's comment about fearing going to the theater, what most people fear is when they walk up to a theater and they see that the society has been neutered and there's a sign saying you can't take a firearm in, letting a criminal know that that's a killing zone. That's what I fear in a theater. Now, the questions about these weapons, the page is going to pass out some pictures. The AR-15, sir, happens to be one of the most popular hunting rifles there are. Ms. Martens said that she hasn't run into anybody out there. AR-15 is used for prairie dog hunting, coyote hunting. It's legal for big game. They're all over in the woods. There's 10 million in ownership. They're off the shelves here. People use them for hunting all the time. An AR-15 has different platforms. You can take them apart. You can put different larger calibers on there. So I don't know where that comes from. The weapons weren't around as we were children. They sure were. I'm about as old as you are, and these weapons have been around forever. The M1A1 Grand, the 30 caliber carbine with the extended clip, and that's a fairly small shell. There is lots of weapons, and the Velocity, the 220 Swift and 2506, there are lots of small calibers that are much faster than these bullets and do a lot more damage, and so it's just painful to listen to this testimony.
Okay, Representative Cornish, could you ask the question? I appreciate the comment.
Well, I'm just wondering where these statistics come from, because everything shows us this is a popular hunting rifle.
Why do you claim
that it's only for killing people? It's a perfect weapon, actually, for self-defense of your home. So I'm just, where do you get these statistics that say that it's not a hunting weapon and it's only for close combat? The picture I'm passing around is 225 yards where I shot a coyote and we're shooting prairie dogs at 300 yards. So where do you get the close combat?
Mr. Egelhoff, do you want to respond to that?
Yes, I don't know where to start, but I'll start in the order, I think. I hunt. I've never seen an AR-15 out in the woods for deer hunting. I accept that there are prairie dog hunters and varmint shooters and also long-range competitive shooters, which I think is the only legitimate use that we should need to be concerned about for these weapons. However, for the small amount of people, I believe, who use a 223 AR-15 platform of any manufacturer, and there are over 80 manufacturers in the United States, does not warrant making these weapons available for 320 million people, of whom several of them are going to turn into be school shooters. And to correct you, sir, the M1 Garand is a 30-06 rifle. The M1A1 rifle is a magazine-fed version, semi-automatic version of the M14, and shoots a 308 round.
Great.
I don't remember what else you've said, but as to these weapons being all over the woods, they're not.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
The Red Lake shooting, I happened to work in Red Lake also up there. I was a game warden for 20-some years. I was up there. The Red Lake shooting that you brought up, he shot the security guard when he came in. The reason that people died there wasn't anybody in the school to defend the school. It was an unarmed security guard. Wasn't that right? And what stopped that carnage? What actually stopped him from doing more damage?
Mr. Egelhoff.
I was the case agent. I arrived 30 minutes after the shooting, and I received the call that a Columbine had happened at Red Lake. Derek Brunn was unarmed, and he shouldn't have been unarmed, and there was no excuse for him being unarmed, and that's a whole different issue from this. The other issue is what stopped him. Well, he was armed with a shotgun, a police shotgun, and he was armed with a Glock pistol with multiple 15-round magazines, which he had killed his grandfather to get, and he was armed with a .22 caliber pistol, which he had used to murder his grandfather to get those guns. He also, what he really wanted was the AR-15 that his grandfather had, a police weapon. And he just messed up loading it. And if that weapon had made it into Red Lake High School, there is no measure of what carnage that would have created.
What stopped him?
Representative Cornish, please go to the chair.
Armed police officers stopped him.
Representative Cornish.
Done, right?
Representative Cornish.
Well, this is preposterous.
Just go through the chair, and I'll call
okay,
on
Mr.
you.
Okay, Mr. Chair, this is really preposterous. It's painful to listen to these misstated facts. Oh.
Okay. You know, Representative Cornish, we can have a discussion here or we can have chaos here, and I don't think that's going to do any good. And I'd also ask the committee here, I'm just thinking that maybe we should hear this bill in its entirety to give everyone an opportunity, and Ms. Martens and the opposition. I don't want to shortchange people who want to testify, and if we have to come back and do 242 later, what is the committee? Is Representative Uglum, you have a question? Representative Lesch, you had a question? I'd like to, and we have, this is our opportunity to discuss. What do people think about that? I'd like, do you want to just do want this one bill today, since it seems to, okay. Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a question for Ms. Martens. I think so much of the media and so much testimony here is equating the so-called assault rifle with machine guns. Nothing could be further from the truth. I think you realize that. The AR-15 or similar guns are semi-automatic, and they shoot every time you pull the trigger. Now, I've shot fully automatic AK-47s and everything else. There is no comparison. And we continually fan the flames and tell the public that these things, assault rifles, are just like combat, and they're not. They're not. They're semi-automatic guns, very similar to a deer rifle with the exception of the clip. And then I would like to also mention that your ballistics are way off. With the assault rifle shooting, you're stated 3,100 feet per second. Well, a small caliber deer rifle, a 243 Remington, and Representative Johnson and I just looked that up, is 3,850, okay? Much more feet per second, more powerful, faster than the round that you referred to. So when we're talking about battlefield weapons, nothing could be further from the truth. And I just want to go on a record on that. And I would like to ask you, how do you claim that these are like machine guns?
Mr. Egelhoff.
I disagree with what you just said about the difference between a semi-automatic AR-15, 223, and a battlefield weapon. It is, in fact, a semi-automatic version of a battlefield weapon, which was designed to be a battlefield weapon. I can tell you, as someone who has carried these weapons on duty and fired them on duty, that there is not a whit of difference between a semi-automatic weapon that has a 30-round magazine and a fully automatic weapon with a magazine. And, in fact, most police officers would tell you they would rather go up against a fully automatic weapon because they can't be held on target, and they spray all over the place. It's called spray and pray. In fact, our military trains its officers, and the FBI trains its hostage rescue team, which performed the rescue down in Alabama the day before yesterday, never to use fully automatic fire because it is inaccurate.
Thank you. So can we... Okay, Representative Neuberger. I really okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr.
I'm
Chair.
Sorry, Representative Lesch.
And
then
Mr.
then Neuberger.
Mr. Engelhoff, my question is actually a lot more specific to the bill, not overall philosophy, but lines 8.27 through 8.29. Specifically, you had mentioned training in military and police officers. I'm wondering if you would have objection, you personally. I mean, I'm sure you can't speak for the author or other organizers, but it states any government, this is the exception to this law, would be any government officer, agent, or employee, member of the armed forces of the United States, or peace officer. And then it says, to the extent that the person is otherwise authorized to acquire or possess an assault weapon, it does so while acting within the scope of the person's duties. Would you personally have any objection to excising that language, to the extent that the person is otherwise authorized to acquire or possess an assault weapon and does so while acting within the scope of the person's duties? And I ask that for a specific reason. I'm an infantry-trained officer, and I have a platoon of individuals in southern Minnesota who are obligated to be trained on one of these weapons. And as you know, shooting is a perishable skill. I shoot expert, but when I fail to train adequately, I slip into sharpshooter. And it's only when I fail to train on my own time to do that. The Guard does not provide
adequate opportunities to train on these weapons, and as citizen soldiers, we are obligated to do that on our own. And in doing that on our own, it would criminalize that behavior that we are otherwise obligated to do, but not under orders and doing at the same time. So my question is...
Mr. Egelhoff, can you answer the question?
No, I'd have no objection. I believe that's a proper use and possession of one of these weapons, for, as you just mentioned. There are also other exceptions, I think, that the Commissioner of Public Safety can review, such as a long-range competitive shooter who's active in the sport, perhaps security guard companies.
Mr. Representative Neuberger, and then we're going to hear the rest of the proponents of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little disturbed here by what I'm hearing. First of all, the opening statements were prefaced by Representative Hausman reading an email that was quite intense. Using one email to stereotype the 1,400 that I have currently in my inbox, I think is a is wrong. Using one email to make everyone that has come down here look like they're extremists is wrong. Prefacing this whole the context of what we're talking about, one of the things that was brought up was there was an interview, or someone had asked someone from the BBC what they thought of Americans, and the quote was, "They think we're all nuts." You know, I could care less what the BBC thinks about us. This is the United States of America.
Representative Neuberger, if you could ask a question, I appreciate the comment. If you have a question for either of the testifiers, please do that now.
I'm sorry.
We're running out of time, and I
ask. Define assault for me. When we're talking about assault weapons, would you define the word for me, please?
Mr. Egelhoff, do you want to take it?
I think it's a compact, magazine-fed, semi-automatic rifle that generally will have a shorter barrel length than a hunting rifle. I think it will have certain features that aid in rapid fire, such as barrel shroud. I think it will fire a round that is generally smaller than a full-size hunting rifle, as I've already explained. And to define it for features, characteristically, it's going to have a pistol grip. It may have a folding stock or a collapsible stock. It can be equipped with other auxiliary features such as a flash hider.
Mr. Egelhoff, I'm just going to cut you off
yes.
here because it's already explained in the bill, Representative Neuberger, and you haven't a chance to read it. I'm going to ask if you could just suspend the question for now and let the proponents finish up, that's okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Egelhoff. The next testifier.
Mr. Chair, Tim Dolan will testify.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Dolan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. I'm the former chief of Minneapolis with 35 years of law enforcement experience. There should be no doubt that I'm here under no pressure from anyone but my own beliefs, and there never has been in my testimonies. I was the chief that handled the exit signage shooting. I was also the chief that oversaw scenes, investigations, community reactions to about 40 homicides each year, which is about half in the state of Minnesota every single year. I'm also a gun owner. I'm voicing my support to proposed legislation against assault weapons. As a member of Major City Chiefs for the last 6 years, we unanimously passed a resolution over 2 years ago to reinstitute the federal ban on the sale, transfer, manufacture, and importation of assault weapons. Recently, they restated this position. These are chiefs from the 50 largest city departments in the United States. They are some of the most respected law enforcement officials in the world. None of them are pressured by mayors or outside sources. We did it because of public safety, because it's the right thing to do. I have a copy of their letter dated December 28th. Here I can leave. The reason we are unanimous in support of an assault weapon ban is that we are seeing an increase in assault weapon shootings across the country. It's a fact that annual mass shootings have doubled since the assault weapon ban expired in 2004. We are seeing increasing attacks on police officers with assault weapons. Assault weapons are especially dangerous to police officers. When we respond to calls, we are most often in a reactive mode. If we have department-issued assault weapons, those are deployed if and when the situation determines that they may be necessary. We don't carry them routinely to people's doors or on the beat. An assault weapon in the hands of an assailant gives them a huge advantage over your initial responding officer, since they are accurate and lethal from much longer distances than the standard weapons an officer carries. I know assault weapons in their capacities. I was a SWAT entry team officer. I carried an MP5 machine gun. As a sergeant, I was a SWAT entry team supervisor. I was also a department trainer in the use of MP5 machine guns and M16 rifles. As a sergeant, I was also an entry team member with the Minneapolis FBI SWAT team. As a lieutenant, I was the commander of the MPD SWAT team. I knew the capacities of all our weapons, and unlike other firearms we carry, including sniper rifles, assault weapons have the capacity to be a weapon of increased lethality in the wrong hands. We saw this recently in Newtown. Assault weapons are military weapons. They are weapons of war. Police only have them today because the assailants they are facing are armed with them more increasingly numbers. However, they should not be in the hands of regular citizens. They should not legally be in the hands of any citizen. You don't need them for sport. You don't need them to hunt. You also don't need them for self-protection in your home. I will leave you with this story. On July 17, 2001, a man named David Joseph Burns in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, decided he did not like the police officer who lived nearby. Mr. Burns clearly had anger issues in his history of violence. 30 years before, he shot and killed both his estranged wife and her boyfriend. He served 6 years before being paroled. Mr. Burns also really liked guns. He amassed several handguns, rifles, and an assault weapon. He also had hundreds of rounds of ammunition. Burns shot Columbia Heights school liaison officer Mike McGee as he was walking home from work with what was thought to be a shotgun and chased him into a neighbor's home. He then shot several rounds into the home. Burns was able to call 911 and ask for help. He was extremely worried about his two children that were home alone. Officers responded from several agencies, including Minneapolis Police Department. What transpired was a half-hour walking shootout between Burns with his assault rifle and police through the neighborhood. You can find exceptional footage on this event on YouTube today. During the gun battle, two or more officers were shot. Two more officers were shot and wounded. Officer Val Dietz of Columbia Heights and Officer Judy Rollins of Minneapolis, who responded from the precinct I commanded. When Officer Rollins went down, her partner Officer Dave Holm got out of their squad and went around the car to pull her out of the line of fire. Burns took a position of cover and was waiting for Holm to fully expose himself. Minneapolis Officer Lance Ulrich, an expert marksman, saw Burns taking aim on Holm and fired at him with a shotgun from over a half block away. Amazingly, one of his pellets hit Burns and put him down. These officers were seriously outgunned. It happened here in Minnesota. Lance Ulrich shot, saved lives. Luckily, all three wounded officers did recover. I asked committee members to find the facts, read the studies. They show that the 1994 assault weapon ban was effective. They also show that since it expired in 2004, annual mass shootings have doubled, as I said. Get the facts. I thank you for your time. I wish you well on a very difficult decision.
Thank you, Chief Dolan. The next testifier is Jane Kay.
Jane Moline, sorry.
Jane Moline. Representative Kiefer, if I ask, if we do questions, these testifiers won't get to testify. I'm really sorry. And then the opponents, I'm going to have to cut their time. I mean, it's up to you. If you want to, we can hear and hear and hear, but I... Representative Kiefer.
I thought we were going to discuss this whole bill the whole time.
We are, but I you know, there's four more people on their list, and then if we want to be fair to the opponents, we should give them 45 minutes. but if you have something quick, do it.
No, it's okay.
Okay. Miss.
Good morning. Jane Moline.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have your name wrong. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. My name is Jane Moline. I live in Dundas, Minnesota, and my state representative is David Bly, and my state senator is Kevin Dahl. I am a certified public accountant with more than 30 years' experience, but I am making my comments today as a wife, a mother, and occasional bank robber. We are a family that owns guns. We have guns in our house. We have guns around us a lot of the time. My husband, Chip DeMann, is leader of the James Younger Gang in Northfield, Minnesota. So we rob banks. I started working with Chip and the James Younger Gang in 1976. We reenact the famous failed bank robbery attempt in Northfield where the townspeople rose up against the terroristic James Younger Gang and ran them out of town. My official title is the gang's choreographer. We have reenacted train robberies, bank robberies, and took the gang to Germany in 2006 and toured doing 6 reenactments with borrowed horses and guns that met the strict regulations there. By the way, for the James Younger Gang, crime does not pay. We have never gotten any money from all of our bank robberies. I have costumed up and ridden as a gang member. Being in the James Gang means you have to handle period-style handguns and long guns. The first time I shot a gun was in high school. This was really in the olden days. Our physics teacher brought a shotgun to school on the assigned day, and at the appropriate hour, we trooped outside to the football practice field across the street from residential neighborhoods and took turns firing the shotgun. We measured and calculated speed, velocity, force, scatter, and other relevant factors. It was not necessary for understanding the physics of firearms. We could have learned the information from a lecture or studied it from a book. But the lesson was all the more impressive when we also got a field trip and some target shooting. I had high school friends who brought their deer rifles in their trucks to school so they could go hunting right after, or those that came with their shotguns after an early morning of bird hunting. To us in high school, guns were a tool for a specific purpose. Like any tool, you had to know how to safely operate it and take responsibility for its safe handling and storage. When I started working with and riding with the James Younger Gang, I had to handle handguns safely, often while riding and controlling a running horse. We have 3 children who have grown up with guns around them an unusual amount of time. We have made up to 30 appearances a year with guns, and we usually brought our kids along. Even when they were very young, they spent time in camp with the James Gang. Gun safety was always an important concern, and all of the gang are especially aware of their responsibility for gun safety. Oh, and the James Gang shoots blanks. This is only a little reassuring, since a blank is still very dangerous and can cause serious injury or death. In addition to period guns, actual antiques, period replica, and other reenactment guns, we have varmint guns, small rifles, and hunting guns. Our children all went through local gun safety courses at the appropriate age. Neither Chip nor I have the time or inclination to hunt. Only our oldest has any interest in hunting, yet we think of gun safety training as a practical basic for life. We believe that knowing how to safely handle guns is important for everyone. Our oldest also has his Minnesota concealed carry permit and was an NRA member but declined to renew recently. All 3 of our children now ride and shoot with the James Younger Gang. I support the ban on assault weapons and large capacity magazines. The citizens of Northfield in 1876 were able to fight off the James Younger Gang for a number of reasons, but it was not superiority of weapons. The citizens of Northfield did not use assault weapons. An assault weapon is not the best choice of weapon for hunting. It is not the best choice of weapon for defending yourself, especially at close range. It is a weapon of war used to fire at a rate to provide suppressing fire or to slaughter as many people as possible. They should not have a place in civil society. Gun manufacturers have sported up these weapons of war and encouraged target shooting or other use. These guns are modified for domestic sale and typically have shot choice settings of single shot or semi-automatic. The fully automatic setting not included on the domestic guns, but semi-automatic allows the guns to fire as quickly as the shooter can depress the trigger, faster than a bullet a second. Regardless of how difficult it may be to define an assault weapon, no matter how much some hobbyists want to possess large capacity magazines, we must come up with reasonable regulations. These are the weapons that the criminals want to get, and we can make that more difficult. Opponents of an assault weapon ban claim that such laws don't or won't work. The 1994 assault weapon ban, in spite of its many flaws and in spite of gun manufacturers' successful work to circumvent the regulations, reduced the number of assault weapons used in crimes and reduced the number of large-capacity magazines used by criminals. In one study based in several major cities, the share of recovered crime guns that were assault weapons declined by at least 32% after the federal ban was enacted, and large capacity magazines declined to a low of 10% in 2004, the last year of the ban, and has risen after the ban expired to 22% in 2010. Even though this law was flawed, it did decrease the use of the weapons used by criminals. My friend, an avid hunter, told me he was just reaching the end of his box of shells for his deer rifle. He had had the box for 10 years, and it had originally contained 20 shells. He says that if you didn't hit your deer with the first shot, the second was a waste. No hunter needs a large capacity magazine. No hunter needs rapid fire ability. Banning these weapons and large capacity magazines will make us all safer. It is one step towards a goal for a safer Minnesota.
Thank you for your testimony, John Suter. Representative Cornish, now, Representative Cornish, we have now, I've found out that we have this room now till 12:15, so the opponents will have adequate time, equal time. And there were some questions that were asked of the proponents that took some time also. So you will have your hour. But you, Ms. Martens, you have three witnesses left. You have to be done by in the next 10 minutes.
Okay.
Can we do that?
I think we're on a different list. The next one on the assault weapons ban, I believe, is Jason Adkins.
Okay.
Pardon me, Mr. Chairman. I know that this is a little out of order, and you always
Mr. Olson, we have time. We're going to give the same time that we gave to the proponent to the opponents. If people have to wait a few more minutes, they're going to have to wait.
All right, that seems fair.
I opened it up to some questions, and there's a couple of more witnesses. Ms. Martens, who else do you have?
Jason Adkins.
Okay, Mr. Adkins, please. If you can just be brief, that would be appreciative. I'd be appreciative.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jason Adkins, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to come before you today. Although the Minnesota Catholic Conference explicitly supports both bills being heard today, as well as a number of those being heard yesterday, we come before you less as experts on weaponry and crime prevention, but rather to offer some thoughts concerning some of the moral and ethical considerations related to the problems of gun violence. The horrors of gun violence have deeper roots than just the prevalence of guns in our society. But it does not mean we should not take significant steps to keep weapons designed for and capable of quickly killing many people out of the hands of dangerous people. Persons, not guns, are undoubtedly responsible for the massacres seen around the country. But it is often the gun that makes these mass killings possible. For that reason, guns may be restricted and regulated to protect the common good and everyone's right to live in peace and free from fear. The right to keep and bear arms, like all rights, carries with it responsibilities and limitations, particularly the responsibility to use a dangerous weapon only for lawful and legitimate purposes, such as self-defense and hunting. As weapons become more powerful and capable of being used for destructive and unlawful purposes, as well as have fewer legitimate civilian justifications and uses, such as military-style assault weapons, limitations on their use and purchase become more prudent. In all cases, regulations related to sale and proper arms of guns are an appropriate means of ensuring that the right to own guns is exercised by people qualified and capable of exercising that right responsibly. Let me conclude by making one more point. Our Lord Jesus Christ said, "Blessed are the peacemakers." It is a statement echoed in many faith traditions. In his World Day of Peace message for 2013, Pope Benedict declared that the pursuit of peace is not utopianism, but is truly possible provided we work together to achieve it. We must enact policies that discourage violence as a means of conflict resolution and establishing social order, as well as foster the integral development and well-being of persons, particularly the poor, the addicted, and the mentally ill. Like many problems, the problem of gun violence can be mitigated if we are willing to work together, despite our differences, to achieve the common good. It is our hope and prayer today that all of us will work together as people of peace. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Adkins, for your testimony. Who is next, Ms. Martens?
Jane Kay.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Kay.
Thank you. I am here today as the face of mothers who can't be here because they're busy with their lives, with their children, with their work. In the wake of Sandy Hook, an Indiana mom started a group, 1 Million Moms for Gun Control. Since that time, almost 60,000 members have joined this group, including a chapter here in Minnesota. Based on things that happen with MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, we plan to be allowed to have a conversation in this debate. Enough children have died. We understand that there are people that want to own guns, and we're not telling them they can't. Has been said, assault weapons are mainly used on the battlefield. Our schools should not be battlefields. They are places of learning. In the 2012 elections, it was said that power and money would decide who was elected. But it was women, and we are paying attention. So please, remember, there are millions of moms out there that want you to do the right thing. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Kay. You have four more minutes, Ms. Martens, if you can, your next testifier. Okay. If you have anybody else.
We'll stop here. Our other testifiers are focused on the other bill.
Okay. Do you want to make any closing comments here? Representative Hausman isn't back, but
yes. Members of the committee, I appreciate your willingness to listen and to have a give and take on this question. I've had some very profound conversations with people on the other side of this issue over the past months, and I value them very much. What I am hearing is that the world has changed since Sandy Hook, and I think that there is an openness on the part, not of everyone, but of many, many gun owners, people like my family, to think about new things to do going forward. The track we are on is an arms escalation. The firepower that is out on the streets now is like nothing we have ever seen, and it is getting more and more prevalent to see these kinds of firearms out there. We need to draw the line somewhere. It's never easy, but we have to stop the escalation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So I'm not sure who's organizing. Mr. Rader, do you want to?
Yeah.
Do you have a list of people that you would like to have testify?
I'd like to submit it
to Mr. Chairman. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, we do have it. So, Mr. Rager?
We're hoping to move up a couple of testifiers based on the.
Very good. If you want to just introduce yourself for the record, and we will give the opponents an hour, and we'll have a few questions too if members wanted to ask at some point.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Chris Rager with the National Rifle Association. Before I go into some of the points I want to make, I just want to make clear there were some comments made by Representative Hausman that I think that should be addressed. I think the Supreme Court in Heller resoundingly supported the fact that the Second Amendment is a fundamental individual right, and they definitely cast aside the fact that somehow there was some type of a militia component or collective right to that. And I guess I kind of find it odd that when someone takes an oath to uphold and protect the Constitution, that they would be supportive of giving up a little bit of their rights. And I think part of the job that I do in representing Minnesotans, especially the Minnesotans here in the room today, is to stand up and fight to make sure we don't lose little bits of those rights a little bit at a time. So I think that's important to put out there. But to go to H file 241, this firearm ban, it's failed policy. It's been tried before. And I think what a lot of folks in this room here, legislators and Minnesotans, they want to work on real solutions. And I think there has been some talk in the testimony of the last couple of days about real solutions, for instance, straw purchases and things of that nature. But I think H file 241, it's similar to the ban that the Clinton administration imposed that expired, and it was failed, and it expired in 2004. And during that 10 years that that law was in effect, it was never shown that any aspect of that ban had any impact on the criminal misuse of firearms. The H521, the ban on so-called assault weapons, is not based on how the guns fire or their power. Rather, the ban's based purely on cosmetic features, such as the grip or the adjustable stock. Semi-automatic firearms have been around for over 100 years. They're among the most popular guns for self-defense, target shooting, and hunting. For example, the AR-15 is the most popular sporting rifle in the market right now. Millions of Americans own semi-automatic rifles, making them undeniably commonly owned. Semi-automatic firearms are not fully automatic military machine guns. Semi-automatic firearms are not more powerful than any other guns. The so-called assault weapons are much less powerful than rifles used to hunt deer and other large game. I think it's important to point out that even here in Minnesota, until a few years ago, they wouldn't allow you to hunt deer or other game with a 223 because it was deemed that it wasn't lethal enough. As the numbers of so-called assault weapons in large capacity magazines have soared to all-time highs, violent crime has been cut in half. The nation's total violent crime rate peaked in 1991. Since then, it's decreased 49% to a 41-year low, including a 52% drop in the nation's murder rate to a 48-year low, nearly the lowest point in American history. Meanwhile, the number of the most popular firearm that gun control supporters call an assault weapon, the AR-15 semi-automatic rifle, has risen by 3.5 million. The number of all semi-automatic firearms has risen by over 50 million. And the total number of privately owned firearms has risen by over 120 million. The number of new magazines that hold more than 10 rounds has risen by tens of millions as well. So-called assault weapons have never been used in more than a small percentage of firearm-related violent crime. Police reports and felon surveys have found that assault weapons are used in only 1 to 2% of all violent crimes. The vast majority of firearms that gun control supporters call assault weapons are rifles, and there are 12 times as many murders with knives, blunt objects like hammers and clubs, and personal weapons like hands and feet than with any type of rifle. And that's also a similar statistic here in Minnesota. There are only 3 murders that used any sort of rifle in 2011 here in Minnesota. The so-called assault weapon and so-called large magazine bans have not reduced crime. After its 1989 ban, California's murder rate increased every year for 5 years, 26% overall. California banned more guns in January 2000, and murder rate has since averaged 14% higher than the national rate. The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives says that it can in no way vouch for the validity of the Brady campaign's claim, repeated by assault weapon ban campaigner Senator Dianne Feinstein, that the federal assault weapon law reduced crime. The FBI does not list guns or gun control as a crime factor, and California doesn't accredit its assault weapon ban for the state's recent decrease in crime. Studies for the CDC, the National Academy of Sciences, and the Library of Congress have found no evidence that gun control reduces crime. And I think it's also important to point out, since we were talking about the Heller case and the Second Amendment, that the court in Heller specifically says that it protects firearms that are commonly possessed here in America. And when there are 10 million owners of what the gun grabbers call assault weapons, you're pretty hard-pressed not to say that that's not a commonly owned and possessed firearm. But I think one last point is to point out kind of how far some of these gun controllers are willing to go to trample on our Second Amendment and other rights. If you look in the bill, if you decide you want to keep your firearm that you lawfully possess now under this legislation, you would have to succumb to a number of things, but you would have to succumb to allowing law enforcement to do in-home inspections to see what firearms you have and how you're keeping those firearms, and I really don't think that's American. So we would ask members to oppose this legislation, and I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Mr. Rager. Representative Neuberger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You have a question, Mr. Rager, do you want to stay? I assume that's for you.
Actually, I wanted to echo back on, get to a point that was brought up from those that were opposed to this. I yielded my time accordingly. The point I'm trying to make here, Mr. Chair, is we're trying to ban weapons that have more than, basically what this bill says is that if you have a firearm with that carries more than 7 rounds, and you're going to be a criminal. You're going to turn thousands of law-abiding citizens into criminals if you pass this thing. Now, people talk about trying to define assault. What is an assault?
You're talking about an assault weapon?
I'm talking about the word. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, my blood pressure is going up. I'm talking about the term assault. All right. 25 years ago, I was a brand new paramedic. The very first assault I ever went on was a man stabbed in the side of the head with a 6-inch screwdriver. Is that an assault weapon? So let's be very careful when we start playing with semantics and we start playing with words here. Now let's talk about this a second. When you talk about high-capacity magazines, this bill, what I'm getting from this bill is the philosophy of this bill is that if you've got a 6-round revolver, that's all you need for personal protection. Well, is it? Well, if it's one-on-one, it's fine. Maybe. Depends on how well of a shot you are. Now, we heard people talk about testimony here about having these high-capacity magazines. What do you do if you're a mother and if there's a home invasion? What do you do when there are more than one attacker? What do you do when you are in your car or you are in your home and there's a gang that's coming after you? People smile and shake their heads no. Well, wait a minute. What happened post-Katrina? There was chaos. There was no law enforcement. There was no military. There was chaos in the streets. High-capacity magazines have a place in this. I don't call these assault weapons. I call them defense weapons. And law-abiding citizens who obey the law should not be denied their Second Amendment rights to have these.
Representative Neuberger, did you have a question for anybody? Because I can bring the proponents of the bill back up if you want, or if Mr. Rager, you wanted him to respond, or did you just want to make the point?
I'm happy with the point for now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate the time. Question for Mr. Rager. On this bill, House File 241, 914, Subdivision 5, the registration for assault weapons. It says here that who desires to keep ownership or possession of the weapon shall comply with the following requirements. Submit to a background check conducted by your chief of police. 922, immediately register this weapon if you want to keep it with the appropriate law enforcement agency. 926, agree to allow the agency to inspect the storage of the weapon and ensure compliance with subdivision. 928, annually review the registration subject to the completion of a new background check. And 930, possess the weapon only on property owned or immediately controlled by that person or while engaged in the legal use of the weapon in a duly licensed firing range or transporting the weapon in compliance with the United States Code. Sir, in your estimation, are we disenfranchising all the owners of assault rifles, and what do you think would be the effect of this registration on our constituents?
Mr. Rager.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I've never seen a bill like this, and like I said, I think it's un-American. I think there are many of law-abiding Minnesotans who choose to have this type of firearm for the defense. I've heard some people say here, why do you need that? I didn't know it was a bill of needs or wants. I thought it was a bill of rights. So I think that when Minnesotans decide to, this is what firearm is suitable for them, maybe based on their size, maybe based on their capacity, this is what they choose. And now we're gonna turn that right into a privilege, and only if the government allows us to have those firearms. And I think that's a flies in the face of the Second Amendment.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lugo, did you have another?
No, I'm good. Thank you.
Representative Kiefer, Mullery, and then we're going to go back to the testifiers because we're going to start running into the same problem as we did with the proponents.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's not really a question. I just want to make a comment. It's not my MO to use anecdotal stories, but we did talk a little bit about an email at the beginning of the committee. And I want to share an email that I got from my Swing District soccer mom area of Woodbury, Minnesota. And she, I'm not going to disclose her name, but I'll give it to you, Mr. Chair, privately. But she did save her daughter's life from a potential kidnapping with her AK-15. The reason she had an AK-15 is she uses it to protect some livestock with coyote. So I just wanted to share that with the committee and get that on record. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Keeper. Representative Mueller, briefly.
Mr. Chair, I just have a point of order. I don't think it's appropriate for people to come up here and insult members of this body who as calling them un-American and things like that.
Representative Mallory, I think he said that the bill was un-American, and I guess I would let that open, unless I heard that wrong, but maybe I heard it wrong.
Mr. Chair, I think the author would then be called that.
Members of the audience, please. I mean, the issue is very divisive. We have strong opinions. Let's try to be respectful in our debate. Mr. Strasner?
Rob Dorr. Sorry, we had to adjust some things.
Oh, Mr. Dorr.
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm a firearms instructor, a DNR hunter safety instructor, and a wide array of other firearms. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'd like to display some firearms that we have cleared with Capitol Security.
I told Mr. Olson you could do that, but I'm not particularly happy about it. But that's all been cleared by security?
Yes, sir. We have followed the appropriate procedures. Yep. All right. First, what I want to show here, by appearance, this would be a common hunting rifle, target shooting rifle. It's got the traditional appearance. Nothing too overtly threatening about it. Now here is a rifle that by reading lines 2.30 through 3.3, it has the ability to accept a detachable magazine. It's got a pistol grip. It's got a protruding grip. It's also got a folding or telescoping stock. This one in particular is telescoping, and it's got a shroud that extends over the barrel. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4 times deadly, I guess. What might surprise you is that these two firearms are actually the exact same firearm. They are Ruger 10/22s. The only thing that is different between these two rifles is entirely cosmetic. The function, the projectile, everything about these two firearms, down to what is legally considered a firearm, the receiver, is exactly the same. So I would caution you when you're looking at banning a wide array of guns, not based on anything other than just their cosmetic appearance. Some of these cosmetics are actually are beneficial. So they are, while cosmetically similar to what would be considered a military style, and note the word there, style, as in fashion, because it looks like it. These do serve some purpose. Okay, thanks. Some of you may have noticed I am 6'5". I'm rather tall. My wife is 5'4". If any of you, we have shared a car until recently, and one of my biggest complaints is when I get into the car and my knees smash into the steering wheel. We are very different sizes. We need different things to accommodate that. This rifle with the telescoping stock allows me, my daughter, maybe one of my DNR hunter safety students with shorter arms, can carry this. My wife, in this position, when I'm shooting it, all the way out. The same firearm can now be used by all three potential members of my family that would be using it, and we don't need to buy specific rifles for everybody. This doesn't affect anything about the function of the firearm, how fast it shoots, how deadly it is, the accuracy of it, only to make it more comfortable for me to shoot, my wife to shoot, or any of my potential students to shoot. Same thing goes with the pistol grip. My wife is left-handed. I am right-handed. Many rifles are not very friendly to people who are the opposite hand. So if you take a left-handed rifle, it doesn't work very well for a right-handed person and vice versa. Having a pistol grip allows ambidextrous use of rifles. Forward grip is also very good for people with short hands. I'm sure Mr. Olson could attest to that as well. Not to pick on him too much. My wife has a hard time extending her hand up here, and especially when we're using the optics, if she's doing longer range shooting, this keeps her hand out of the way of the optics and down where she can hold it comfortably. I'm very concerned about the writing in this bill. I think people don't understand it. The writing in this bill is actually so loose with the exemptions that it removes and the specificity that it removes, even revolvers. Could be considered banned. Regular revolvers, because of their ability to shoot shot shells. The bill doesn't define shotguns, but defines any shotgun with a revolving cylinder, and that would qualify most revolvers, as there are shot shells available in most revolver calibers. So, you're looking at these guns, you might think, I've already kind of tipped the deck that they fire the same projectile. As was mentioned before, this on my left here is a .30-06. This shoots a 30 caliber bullet. This right here is a .223, so this is what would be more commonly found in like an AR-15 caliber. What these two guns shoot is a .22, that little guy right there. So, we're not looking in the right place. We're looking at cosmetics. We're looking at things that make guns easier to use for a wider variety of people for perfectly legitimate purposes, and we're not focusing on anything that makes these guns any more or less lethal. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you for your presentation. I don't know if that was a first in this committee room or not, but okay, the next testifier, if you could come up. It would be good to get maybe House research just for the edification of the committee. Mr. Clary, I don't know, I'm not asking you to speak about this right now, but it would be you could put together a memo to the committee on the presentation that is being made, because I would suspect there are other members of this committee that aren't experts on guns like me. And it would be helpful to get sort of an overview of what the bill says relative to the description of these weapons and what the opponents are saying, if that's possible. You don't have to do it right away. We're not going to be dealing with this bill till later in the month, but the more information we have, I think, the better or more informed our decisions will be.
Yes, I'd be happy to, Ms.
Thank you, Mr. Clary. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Adam Ballard. I'm the product manager for DPMS, a St. Cloud-based company manufacturing modern sporting rifles for the hunting, shooting sports, home defense, law enforcement, and military markets. I'm here to discuss the economic impact of this legislation. We operate a manufacturing and distribution facility that employs 115 full-time employees, 37 of whom, including myself, have served proudly in the U.S. Armed Forces. DPMS has a current payroll of approximately $3.32 million. And we do more than $33 million in business with other companies in Minnesota, mostly manufacturers of metal and plastic components, as well as printing and packaging. DPMS contributes more than $100 million annually to the Minnesota gross state product. In 2012, we were responsible for more than $20 million in federal taxes, $6 million in state taxes, and $2.5 million in local taxes. If enacted into law, this legislation being considered today by this committee would end our ability to manufacture in the state. To be clear, a ban on the manufacturing and sale of modern sporting rifles would close our doors in Minnesota. Our employees would be sent home, our jobs gone, many of our suppliers jeopardized. On a personal note, I'm deeply concerned about any legislation aimed at curtailing our Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms and other civil liberties. It's not justified to focus on literally tens of millions of law-abiding citizens like me who use modern sporting rifles for hunting, recreational shooting, and home defense. As an Army veteran who spent nearly 10 years in two deployments carrying a true assault weapon in service to this country, I can tell you our modern sporting rifles are not assault rifles they're made out to be. Though some of our MSRs may look like military rifles, they function no differently than any other civilian firearm, firing only one round with each pull of the trigger. A comprehensive study by the Centers for Disease Control in 2003 looked at 51 different studies covering all gun control measures, including the 1994 assault weapons ban, and the conclusion was that none had reduced crime. Another study commissioned by Congress found that bans were not effective in reducing crime because, quote, the banned weapons and magazines were never used in more than a modest fraction of all gun murders, end quote. In fact, all long guns, which modern sporting rifles are only a portion, are used in less than 3% of all crimes involving a firearm. Since the assault weapon ban expired in 2004, the nation's violent crime rate has continued to drop and is now at the lowest level since the early 1970s. This has happened in spite of the fact that the number of modern sporting rifles owned by law-abiding Americans has increased substantially in recent years. Speaking as an employee whose professional future you now hold in your hands, and as a father of two children, who shares your concerns for wanting to keep guns out of the hands of prohibited persons, I urge you to focus on real crime control measures and not another gun ban that will only affect law-abiding citizens. As a state, let's work to ensure we submit all appropriate court data of those individuals adjudicated unfit to possess a firearm to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, not private medical records, but official court documents. Further, let's enforce existing laws and use strong tools already at our disposal, such as the 10-year, $250,000 perjury penalty associated with straw purchasing. Or even better, let's make straw purchasing its own offense. By using federal laws to prosecute gun-related crimes, we can ensure criminals don't plead down to lesser offenses. Armed robbery should never become robbery because of a busy court docket. When Richmond, Virginia did this under a program called Project Exile, crime dropped 65%. Finally, we need to do more to promote education efforts that teach gun owners, especially new gun owners, how to safely store firearms for unauthorized users. These are concrete steps we can take today. Thank you very much. On behalf of the entire DPMS family, I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today and hope you'll continue to support the Second Amendment and our employment as proud Minnesotans.
Thank you, Mr. Ballard, for your testimony. Mr. Olson, I think you're next on the list, unless someone had a question.
Sort of play cleanup. We have a couple of other people. One gentleman who, Mr. Collins would be next.
Okay, Mr. Collins. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for letting me hear my testimony. My name is Kevin Collins, C-O-L-L-I-N-S. I'm here from Orinoco, Minnesota. You've heard much over these last 2 days on personal protection and the Second Amendment. I'm here to give you a little different, an additional perspective. Although I'm a firearms instructor, a permit holder, a competitive shooter, and I have a lot of opinions on the rest of these, that's not the capacity I'm here in. The capacity I'm here in, I'm the chairperson of the building committee for the Pine Island White Pine Sportsman's Club. We are just finishing a new remodel. We spent nearly $1 million on the building and new bays and two new rifle ranges. Our clubhouse and range is set to open here in early March. The basis of this, what's really footed the bill, paid the bills for these enhancements, is really the shooting sports. Primarily, in our case, USPSA and Minnesota and Three Gun. These shooting sports involve setting up courses of fire where competitors run on a timer through courses that represent realistic defensive scenarios. They're growing at a huge rate within the United States. We're one of about 500 USPSA clubs, for example, across the country. We happen to be one of eight in the state of Minnesota. We even attract at our competitions, we attract competitors from all over the country, clearly within the tri-state area for sure. And just to give you an example of how much this has grown, over the last 3 years we've had at just our club 3,000 different competitors in the USPSA competitions that we've had. These competitors have shot over that time well in excess of 300,000 rounds, and I might add, without a safety issue. These sports, the reason I'm focusing on these sports are based on using modern sporting rifles, what's referred to here as the assault weapons. They use modern sporting rifles. They use standard, what I call standard capacity mags, those magazines that come with your handguns already, or what's referred to in the next bill, 242, as large capacity mags. Any passage of 241 or 242 would be devastating to the sport in the state of Minnesota. It would be devastating particularly to our club, which is about to open. At a minimum, this is going to force each of the competitors to spend hundreds or thousands of dollars to upgrade their equipment. More likely, in many cases, it will shut down the sport for many in the state of Minnesota. As you've heard in this testimony, none of these bills are directed at the criminals. They're directed at law-abiding citizens. None of them have a lot of promise for improving public safety. They will, however, have a very direct impact on law-abiding citizens who choose to participate in the sport. In closing, I urge you to continue to support our Second Amendment rights.
Thank you, Mr. Collins. Thank you for your testimony. Next. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Futh. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. My name is John Futh, and this is my son, Gunner. On the 4th of July, 2009, we were visiting family when my son was shot, almost killed on the street outside my brother's house. Kerry Schmidt, I had the news earlier, who was drunk and angry, shot at my son and others because they were lighting off firecrackers. I almost lost my son that night. I held him in my arms as he bled on me. I kept him from going to sleep. I said, "Stay with me. Stay with me." The shooter was convicted of first-degree assault and sentenced to more than 7 years in prison. What he did was irresponsible. It was unforgivable. But no amount of gun control, no amount of regulation, background checks, magazine limitations, this guy used an old Marlin 22 rifle. No amount of law would ever stop this guy from making a bad, drunken decision he made that night. My son, thank God, made a full recovery and is in school today at St. Croix Lutheran in West St. Paul, Minnesota. Tomorrow he has an interview with a college recruiter from Dartmouth. When he was 8 years old, he told me he was going to cure cancer one day, and I think he'll do that. He and I got a gift from God, the opportunity to spend more time together on this earth. We spend some of that time going to the shooting range together. He has a Ruger 10-22, like the ones that you saw today. It shoots the same 22 round that almost killed him. He owns normal capacity 25 round magazines. He's a great shot, and he's as safe as a shooter can be. Why would you take away from me, take away from my son, our constitutional right to keep and bear arms? When people, thousands of people, are injured and killed by drunk drivers, we don't blame it on cars or demand a limit on car size. We put the blame where it belongs, on the person who breaks the law. Deal with the criminals, Mr. Chairman. Help the people who badly need mental health care. Don't take away my son's right, my right as an American, in the hope that somehow you'll make bad people stop doing bad things. Thank you.
Representative Cornish. Representative Cornish.
If I could ask you folks a favor in the crowd, if you could not applaud anymore when I speak or anybody else speaks, it actually makes us look bad. It's kind of rude here, even though, you know, I appreciate it in the overflow rooms where we can't hear it. But please don't applaud anymore, no matter how hard you I feel very emotional about the subject, too, but try not to applaud. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Futh. Who is next? Okay. Mr. Johnson. Yes, Mr. Johnson, Chairman. Welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Ryan Johnson, and I've been a police officer in the inner city. I won't mention the department, and obviously I'm not here speaking on behalf of the police department that I work for. But I've been a police officer for approximately 17 years, and I stand here just against the vast majority of the bills here as they've been written. I, as well as a number of my family and friends, use a lot of these, I'll call them modern sporting rifles. I definitely agree with a number of the members here that they're not assault rifles. I have shot a number of fully automatic machine guns, commonly termed as assault rifles, used by our military, but the bill here, as it's written, is going to preclude myself, as well as a number of my friends and family, from being able to enjoy our competitive shooting sports, as well as the varmint hunting and a number of other types of hunting that we enjoy. I obviously am in here in disagreement with a couple of the law enforcement people that have spoken before me. I respect obviously their right to disagree with me, but I've been on a number of police shootings over my 17 years, including one just a couple of years ago where over 30 rounds were fired by a couple of police officers. That goes to speak to against this proposed magazine capacity ban. If you limit law-abiding citizens such as myself to seven or 10 rounds, that can have a very desperate impact on our ability to defend ourselves, as well as our ability to defend others. One of those instances, over 30 rounds were fired. Seven rounds hit the suspect who was trying to kill a number of police officers, and two of those rounds were fatal. Now, does that mean those officers were bad shots? No, not at all. Combat is unfortunately a very fluid, fast-moving, and unpredictable event. During those times, whether you're at home attempting to defend your family, or whether you're out and about being limited to only 10 rounds and hoping that somebody is standing still and not moving and trying to harm you, is going to be severely limiting to your ability to again defend people. Again, I mentioned that I'm a competitive shooter. I use these modern sporting rifles weekly or monthly. A number of people already testified to the fact that there's going to be a huge, desperate impact to the competitive shooting community. There are a number of fellow police officers like myself that shoot on a department-sponsored competitive shooting team, and we use these type of rifles all the time, and high-capacity magazines. And again, I was just told in the last couple of minutes that there were going to be a little bit extra time for me to testify, so I apologize for a little bit of the choppiness of my notes, but if anybody has any questions, I will make myself available to any questions that you might have.
Here's not. Thank you for your testimony, Mr.
Thank
Johnson.
You.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, appreciate your allowing me to speak today. I'm a former 10th Special Forces.
Sir, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
Doug Brown.
Doug Brown?
Yeah.
Welcome to the committee.
Former Green Beret. I was served with the 10th Special Forces. I'm also the owner of Ballistics Firearm Training Center. I'm a certified organization by the Department of Safety. I'm the current chairman of the FBI Minneapolis Citizens Academy Alumni Association, a member of InfraGuard, and I'm retired from 3M as a telecommunications engineer. I'm here on behalf of myself to talk about this issue. I'm approaching it from a little different angle than everybody else because assault weapons have been covered, but I'd like to talk about the shootings. An examination of the shootings by age of a school shooter from 1996 to 2013 indicates the vast majority of K-12 shooters are around 15 years of age. University shootings are typically early in their early to late 20s. The K through 12 shooters are not of age to legally possess a firearm. The university shooters were either mentally ill, revenge shooters, or domestic affairs. So the shooters that have been doing a lot of these school shootings that have made the headlines and are so prevalent today in the news media that we keep getting told over and over and over again, it's assault weapons. They got those weapons illegally. We should be talking about how did they get those weapons, why did they have those weapons in their hand. Also, the FBI table number 20 for murder by state, Minnesota, shows that only three rifles were used in 2011 to combat a murder, while knives were used to murder 12 people, hands and fists were used to murder three people, and other weapons were used to murder 12 other people. I'm going to skip over some things that were already covered by some other people. One of the things that I looked at when I was doing research on the school shootings was the method of operation. The method of operation is to shoot each individual once and then move on to the next target. Unlike law enforcement, military, we're taught to shoot several times until that target goes down. But what we're seeing in these school shootings is they're shooting once, moving on to the next target, and many times they're using headshots. Why is this? This method is used in mostly in video games and is indicative of past school shootings. For kids to kill, they need three things. They need a tool, usually a gun. They need the skill to use that tool. And finally, they need the will to use that gun. Of these three factors, the military knows that killing simulators take care of two out of three by nurturing both the skill and the will to kill a human being. Operant conditioning is a stimulus response training. The military uses this effectively to increase the killing rate. Video simulators, video games, do the same thing except for one striking, very important exception. Video games don't have rules of engagement, whereas military and law enforcement simulators do. Video games reward shooters who make headshots. The more headshots, the bigger the gun, bigger reward. No constraints at all. Military and law enforcement are taught to shoot multiple times until the assailant is no longer a threat. Video games teach to shoot once, move on to the next target. So we're seeing a generation of youth training on military law enforcement type realistic simulators. This environment for some troubled youth is enough for them to cross the line into a real world shooting. Michael Cornell, the 14-year-old boy who walked through Paducah School and opened fire on a prayer group meeting that was breaking up, never moved his feet in his rampage. He never fired far to the left or right, never far up or down. He simply fired once at everything that popped up on his screen. It is not natural to fire once at each target. The normal, most universal response is to fire at a target until it drops and then move on to the next target. This is the defensive reaction that saves lives. The human instinctual reactions eliminate the threat quickly. Not to shoot one and go on to the next target before the first threat has been eliminated. But most video games teach you to fire each target once, only hitting as many targets as you can as fast as you can in order to rack up a high score. And many video games give bonus points for headshots. I would say to the committee that you need to examine the data that's out there and take a look at what's causing the youth to cross that line and create these mass shootings. They're underage, they aren't of age to own the firearms, and banning assault rifles is not going to do anything to help the problem that we've got with that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brown, for your testimony. Mr. Olson, do you have anybody else? Otherwise, we could...
I have one more, and then myself, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I believe we have about 10 more minutes.
Yes, that would be just fine. Welcome to the committee, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Tim Jazerski. I'm from Two Harbors, Minnesota. Several years ago, I was working for a company helping open an office in Fargo, North Dakota. So from Two Harbors, that was a long ways away from my family. I received a call one evening, and it was from my wife. That call was that somebody had just called my house, threatened to kill her and my three sons. He said he was going to come and shoot him. My wife called the local sheriff's department, the Lake County Sheriff's Department, and asked for protection. The answer she got was quite unique, because you see, our law enforcement doesn't offer protection. And after speaking with the sheriff's deputy for quite a while, she got him to admit, because this was only a threat over the phone and there's no immediate threat or danger, there was nothing for them to do. And so she said, what you're saying is, what you will do is, after we've been killed, you will find and look for who killed us. And he said, yes. It is not law enforcement's job to protect each one of us. It is our right under the Constitution to protect ourselves through the Second Amendment and the use of these guns. My wife's response, because I had taught her to shoot, because she was understanding of guns, to the sheriff was, I have already loaded several guns, one of them being a .308 deer hunting rifle, and if you decide to come to my house and speak to me, you better announce yourself, because anybody who walks through the door is in for trouble, because I will shoot first and ask questions later. And yes, they did come before I got there because of that statement, but basically to tell her to unload the guns and disarm herself to make everybody else safer. So when you say, what do we need these guns for? I would rather she does not run out of bullets if that ever happens, if that person ever shows up. Under duress, I don't think you're going to aim as well as you would on a target range. And if it's more than one person, again, I don't want her to run out of bullets. That's why I oppose this bill. I'm a gun safety instructor. I teach kids how to be safe. I've taught her how to shoot, as well as my boys. I have two in the military. And when we come to saying 30-round clip and how fast you can shoot, my son has been trained to change a clip and a handgun in less than 1 second. He can shoot 30 shots in less than 3 seconds longer than it would take you to use a 30-round clip. So anybody who practices, all we're doing is, you know, we're putting lipstick on a pig. It's not changing it. We're doing things. We're saying, look what we did. We made things safer. And we've done nothing with this bill but disarm honest citizens. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Jezerski. Mr. Olson, do you want to wrap things up?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You've been very gracious to all the speakers, and we appreciate it very much. My name is Joseph Olson. I'm a professor of law at Hamline University, and I am also president of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. Of course, today I appear only on behalf of the Gun Owners Civil Rights Alliance. I'd like to start out for just a moment, because Representative Hausman brought up the Supreme Court case, particularly the Heller case. I actually had one of my articles cited in Heller. I know that Judge Scalia is familiar with my work. I have read the opinion a number of times. I teach it in my seminar at Hamline Law School. The Supreme Court did two things in the Heller case that are relevant to the discussion as Representative Hausman brought it up. One, in Heller, the Supreme Court had made it very clear that the introductory clause to the Second Amendment is not part of the normative statement. In other words, the introductory clause is not part of the rule of law. The rule of law is that the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. And the court went on to discuss just exactly how much the District of Columbia was infringing that right. Furthermore, the court talked in the case about the arms that were protected by the Second Amendment, and it said that the arms that were protected were those that were in common use. Military-style firearms are in common use. In the last 4 years alone, AR-15 style rifles made by DPMS and a variety of other manufacturers have been widely sold. They've sold about 3.4 million of them a year. Why do they sell so many? Because it is rugged, reliable, dependable, accurate, and you can change the upper and change it from a 223 to a larger caliber. I used to go deer hunting with a 308 caliber FNFAL, which is indeed fits all the characteristics on the list of assault weapons, even though it was made in the 1950s. I've now switched to a DPMS in 308 because it's, in fact, safer and easier to use because the controls are easier for me to get. A hold up. If we take a look at, for example, the list of things that make a rifle into an assault weapon, it's like describing whether a woman has a large hat or a small hat, whether someone is wearing, that necklace just strikes me, a necklace or not, whether she's wearing some blue over there, a blue dress or a red dress. It's all cosmetic features. None of them add to the lethality of the firearm. I think we saw that when we had the two 10-22s on display. One of them looks warm and comfy. Grandpa's 22. I have a Ruger Mini 14 that is exactly the same thing. It looks warm and comfortable. It has walnut stock on it. I have another one identical to it, which shoots exactly the same bullets, shoots exactly the same number of bullets per pull of the trigger, exactly the same number of cycles per minute, except that one of them is wearing a black dress, very familiar, and the other one is wearing a red dress, one size too small. It makes a big difference, but it's all cosmetics. This is a pistol grip. Somehow this takes an ordinary rifle and turns it into a killing machine of untold proportions. No, I'll tell you what it does. It makes it easy for a person with small hands, like me, to safely hold the firearm, because I don't have to try and put my arm at a 30-degree angle around a big fat stock. I can put it around the pistol grip. And it's ambidextrous. I happen to be severely left-eyed, so notwithstanding that I'm right-handed, I shoot left-handed. And lo and behold, it's just as easy to hold. And the AR-15 series of firearms were designed so that left-handers could safely use them just like right-handers. So that's the pistol grip. What else do we have? We have protruding grips that are sort of like a pistol grip. All hunting firearms, almost all, 99% of them, since 1903, have had a semi-pistol grip stock. What else are we looking at? Let's see, a telescoping stock. I'm not really, there is no music. I always wear short sleeve shirts. You may have wondered why. It's because I'm 5'4" tall and my arms are 31 inches long, which means I can't buy a shirt that will fit me. Comes out to here. So I have to have shirts that are short enough. I have to have a firearm that I can adjust. And lo and behold, a telescoping stock works perfectly. I could shoot a telescoping stock firearm, and so could someone who's 6'4" tall. It is a safety feature. It is a recoil feature. So all the features of the guns that are listed on here as allegedly evil are all either recoil reduction, safety, or accuracy features. And why do more and more people want them on their guns today? Because they've come to recognize that reliability, accuracy, and safety are good to have. Lastly, let's take just another look at the bill for just a moment. This is an absolutely outrageous bill. It treats semi-automatic firearms in Minnesota worse than machine guns are treated under federal law. Yes, machine guns have to be registered, and yes, you have to go through a background check, But there is no requirement that you let anyone in your house to inspect your storage. There is no requirement of annual registration at another fee. There is no requirement that you can possess the property only on your own property. You can possess it anywhere in the state in which you live. Let me see if that's worse. Oh, and did anybody notice at 10.1, you can register it, you can apply with all the requirements of the state of Minnesota, and when you die, they take it away. It's simply deferred confiscation. Deferred confiscation. It's registration first, followed by deferred confiscation. And whenever I say to legislators, if you're going to register it, you're going to confiscate it, and they say, oh, no, we would never do that. Well, here's proof. Right here. If you register it, we know that you want to confiscate it, and you're going to do it when you get a chance. Well, I hope that you don't get a chance in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Olson, for your testimony. Thank you, everybody, for your testimony and your respectful discussion today. We will be meeting the final day tomorrow from 10 to 12 and into the evening. We have six more bills, and then we will be done for now. Members, any questions? Oh, the chair will lay over House File 241. Any other questions? Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think you've run a really good committee on this important issue. I'm really disappointed that so many members have left this hearing because this is an extremely, extremely important issue. We're talking about our constitutional rights here. I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you.
Representative Kiefer, I appreciate that. But if I could just say that other members, there's other committees going on, and this was supposed to be done earlier, and I apologize for that, but I wanted to give everyone an opportunity who came to testify. This meeting is adjourned.